All right, we're off and running. My name is Brent. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Tracy and Mark for inviting me up here tonight. I know that I was a late-minute fill-in for Ralph White. I heard that he was in the hospital, so I hope everybody takes a minute tonight and thinks about Ralph, and we'll hope that everything goes well. So, anyway, I have a sobriety date. Can you hear me? Okay. I have a sobriety date, August 27th, 1996. I have a home group, and I have a sponsor. And those things are very, very important to me. For me, it does not matter whether I have 6 years, 6 months, or 6 days. I need that sponsor because I have a committee that talks to me up here, and I need somebody to talk to and make decisions and help me work through things. And I'll be honest with you, 28 years in, sometimes my best days is when I need him the most, because when everything's going great, I get to thinking that I can do everything, I can take care of things, and then that's when my life will really start getting crazy. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I am very grateful for that because I have a long lineage of people in this group program, and that's very important. I have a home group, the Pacific group, on Wednesday nights, and that's important to me because that means I'm accountable to those people in that room, and if I'm not there, they're going to check on me, and if the guys aren't there that I know, I'm going to be checking on them. The only way I know how to do this is tell you a little bit about who I was, what happened to me because of the disease of alcoholism, and where I am today because of this program, the fellowship, a great sponsor, and my higher power who I choose to call God. I was born and raised in Southwest Missouri, in the middle of absolutely nowhere on an Angus beef farm, and I hated every minute of my childhood. And when I tell you I was in the middle of nowhere, it was 22 miles before I found people. Growing up on that farm, I 100% idolized my father. Everything I did to get my father to tell me he was proud of me, to give me a pat on the back, to tell me I was doing things the right way, and to tell me that he loved me. That just wasn't who my father was. My dad was the type of man you did things one way, the way he told you to do it, and that was it. Growing up on that farm, alcoholism runs rampant in my family. That is not the reason I am an alcoholic, it's just the way my family was. Neither one of my grandfathers ever made it to the age of 60 because of this disease, and my uncle died at the age of 42. I took my first drink when I was 9. And the reason I did that was after first and second grade, I did not fit in. I did not know how to talk to kids. I did not know how to be a part of the group. And I knew that everybody in those classrooms was making fun of me because my boots was old, because they had dirt on them, they was worn out. My jeans had holes in them, which nowadays you have to pay extra to get jeans with holes in them. So I'd have fit in great today. But I just didn't fit in. And on a Sunday afternoon, my grandpa, my uncle, my dad was sitting underneath the tree listening to a ball game. They'd tell me, go get him a beer and bring and take the old can back and bring them a new one. And I realized when they would drink one or two, their smiles got bigger. If they drank two or three, their laughter got louder and they was having a good time. So I realized whatever was in these cans must be something magical. So I started either finishing off the can when they told me to take the old one back, or I took a swig off the new one when I came back with it. All right, let's give this one a shot. So, before that afternoon was over, I had this little buzzy feeling inside me. But what I learned that day was this. If I drank out of that can, I felt different. I didn't feel the pressure. I didn't feel like I had to fit in. I just felt different. And that's what I was wanting. Now, my drinking didn't explode when I was 9 years old, but I learned if I could get those cans or get that bottle, I could feel different. That's what I was chasing, so that's what I would chase from that point on. Growing up in that small town, if you're even halfway good at sports, you get a lot of breaks, a lot of favoritism. I'm going to say I was better than average because when I was 13, they started having me play ball with the 14, 15-year-olds. Their drinking was on a level that I didn't know about, so I started escalating mine. I had to fit in. I had to be part of the group. And when I drank, they would accept me. And that's what I started doing. My dad, it was the same scenario with him from day one. If I went to school and brought a B home, he wanted to know why it wasn't an A. If I brought that A home, he said, that's the reason you go to school. When I was 16 years old, there's five carloads of us coming back from a float trip. The lead car had a wreck and one of the girls was killed. Her parents and mine had known each other before Joe and I was even born, and they asked me to be one of the pallbearers. The morning of the funeral, I showed up drunk. I stumbled carrying the casket, and I made a real fool out of myself. And that was the first time people started telling me maybe I need to slow down on my drinking. My attitude to them was real simple. This is how I deal with things. I'm taking care of what I need to take care of, so just leave me alone. My junior year in high school, that little town I lived in, probably had one of the best ball teams it had maybe in 20 or 25 years. We ended up making it to the state. We lost in the quarterfinals, and I probably played the best game I'd ever played in my life. And I just knew my father was going to be proud of me when I got home, even though we lost. I didn't get three steps in the door, and he started telling me what I did wrong in the second half. If I'd have shot here, if I'd have passed there, maybe we'd won, maybe we'd be playing for the state championship. So I realized whatever I was going to do was never going to be enough for him. It was never going to get him to tell me what I wanted to hear. My senior year, I started throwing keggers on the backside of the farm down by the river. People was asking me every weekend, when the party going to be? What time can we be there? I was getting that attention. I was getting that feeling inside that people wanted me, and that's what I wanted. I really thought after I graduated high school, I'd be like everybody else in that little small town. You get married to your high school sweetheart, you raise a family, get a job there, you live there, and most people end up dying there. Well, my dad had different plans. He wanted me to go to college. That's the last thing I wanted to do because I hated school my entire life. So that entire summer when all my buddies are getting their own place, they're out doing their own things, I'm stuck on the farm. That fall, I packed up the car, I went to college, and I will tell everybody in this room, on day three, I realized I might have just fallen into paradise. I joined a fraternity, alcohol flowing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there was not one person in my life telling me I need to slow down on my drinking. They told me I needed to drink more, and I had found my people. And my drinking absolutely took off. But there was consequences when my drinking took off. My sophomore year, I started losing friends. People didn't want to ride in the car with me. People didn't want to hang out with me. I got loud. I got stupid. I brought the wrong type of attention to us. My junior year, for an alcoholic, I got possibly the greatest job there was. I became the college rep for the Anheuser-Busch distributorship in that town. And all those fraternities who had banned me the year before not to come to their parties, they all welcomed me. They wanted me to put the big bush blow-up can in the yard, hand out T-shirts, do what I could. I knew they didn't want me there. They just wanted me there for what I could give them. But by my senior year, my drinking wasn't working anymore. I was losing friends. I could be in a room just like this, and I would be 100% alone. I couldn't get enough alcohol in me to have the good times anymore. Somehow I did graduate, had my degree, got a job. I'm working, paying my bills. But I'm miserable. A couple years after I'd gotten out, my mom gave me a call and said, is there any way you can come home and help out? Your dad's getting older, some issues on the farm. So I made plans at work. I took a week off. I got home on a Sunday afternoon. He had a list of chores he needed done. One of the first lists was he needed part of the barn painted. So I woke up Monday morning. I grabbed my beer. I headed out to the barn. He had bought all this paint, and I thought, well, this is absolutely ridiculous. I can paint that section of the barn, use about half the paint, save him some money, and we'll get the week started off on the right foot. So that afternoon when he came out, he didn't tell me I did a good job. He didn't tell me I did a bad job. He just asked me why I didn't use all the paint. I said I didn't need to use all the paint, got the job done, saved you some money. He said if I wanted to save the money, I wouldn't have bought it. You might say after 25 years, alcohol was no longer working in my life. And me trying to please my dad had come to an end. My father and I proceeded to get into a heated argument that afternoon, and I murdered him. I will never know what I did to my mother. My mom stood beside me from day one, second one. And if any of you know anything about a small town, the gossip and the words they said about her was worse than anything they could have done. She bailed me out 3 days later. My drinking took a turn that I didn't know it could have. It just got completely 100% dark. I drank in the morning, I drank in the afternoon, I drank at night. And when I would pass up and wake out at 2 o'clock in the morning, I drank more. And that's what I proceeded to do for the next 10 months till I went to court. I was convicted of second-degree murder, armed criminal action, and given two life sentences. I went to prison October 3rd, 1987. It took this alcoholic exactly 13 days to learn how to make homemade wine, and that's what I proceeded to do. And when I couldn't steal the ingredients out of the kitchen, I'd buy a 6-ounce bottle of aftershave out of the canteen, cook it down to a 1-ounce shot, and I would drink it. I would put anything inside my body to quiet the voices of my head and to fill the void in my heart. Now, my mother and my grandmother come to visit me every single Thursday. They drove 2.5 hours. And it didn't matter if it was August and 106 or if it was January with 9 inches of snow on the ground. They drove 2.5 hours to see me. And when I had that hooch and I had something inside my system, quiet the voices in my head, when they'd walk into the visiting room, I gave them a hug. I thanked them for coming to see me. I thanked them for bringing that little bag of quarters so I could get a sandwich out of the vending machine, and I told them how much I loved them. Then January the 1st, 1992, I woke up my cell floor, my own blood, my own puke. The hooch and that aftershave I was drinking was literally eating my stomach lining out. I still refused to admit that I was an alcoholic. I said, I'll just take matters into my own hands and I'll just quit drinking. And for the next 3.5 years, I really believe I might have been one of the most miserable, meanest dry drunks there were. Because when my mother and my grandmother come visit me on Thursday, and I had nothing inside my head to quiet the voices, my attitude to them was real simple. Visiting room opened 19 minutes ago. Where have you been? I've been waiting. I know there was times I didn't hug them. I know there was times I didn't thank them. But I complained every single week that there wasn't more quarters in that bag so I could get 2 sandwiches instead of 1. And I'm ashamed to say that there was probably some times they walked out of that room and I didn't even tell them I loved them anymore. That's where this disease has taken me. I was miserable. I was broken. I had no morals. I had no values. I had nothing left inside me. 2 guys I had a job with in there that had been on me for almost 2 years tell me that I was an alcoholic. I said, people have been telling me all my life I was an alcoholic. I haven't had anything to drink going on 4 years. I'm not an alcoholic. But at this point in time, my fuse is about this short, and I was ready to swing on one of them. And I said, what do I have to do to get you 2 off my back? I said, go to an AA meeting, we'll leave you alone. I looked them both in the eye and I said, I go to 1 meeting, you 2 will leave me alone. They said, yes. So I signed up, took about 2 weeks to get on the call out. I went that Sunday night, I sat in the back left-hand corner, I stared at the floor, I absolutely did not introduce myself, I did not raise my hand to anything, I paid no attention to what you all said. When that 60 minutes was over, I pushed 2 chairs out of the way, probably tripped over one, and headed back to my cell. And the only thing I could think of on the way back was, let's just see if these 2 leave me alone. And you know what, they did. They didn't say a thing to me on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or the rest of the week. And the only thing I can ever tell anyone who will ever listen to me for the rest of my life is this. Something happened to me that night that I did not know. Because Sunday afternoon came and they called the AA over the intercom and I went back to that room. And I sat in that same chair and I stared at the floor and I talked to myself and I asked myself, why am I back here? And I proceeded to do that for 3 months before I ever raised my head up. And I realized one night that those men were talking about me. They were talking about how they didn't fit in. They were talking about how they never had the right girlfriend, the right clothes, the right car, that they didn't live in the right neighborhood. They couldn't get people to like them. And I grabbed a big book off the table that night and I took it back to my cell. And I read a couple pages and I thought, well, this stuff isn't too bad. And then I'd read a few more pages and start talking about me, and I'd throw that book over on that bunk and it'd lay there for 2 or 3 days. And that's literally how I cycled through the first 10 months of AA, but I went back every Sunday night. 3 men who was bringing the meeting into prison, people just like yourselves, you had to volunteer to bring the meeting in. They were put in the meeting. They put on what they called a big book workshop. It was 15 weeks long. And I decided, what have I got to lose? So I went to, and those 15 weeks changed my life. Before those 15 weeks was up, at the age of 34, I admitted I was an alcoholic. I also realized that the sheriff and the judge and the prosecutor was doing their job. And most importantly, I started realizing that my father was a good man and he loved me the only way he knew how. It just wasn't what I needed at that time. And I asked one of those 3 men to be my sponsor. And I started learning exactly who you all are, because he would come in every other Sunday, 1 hour early, to start taking me through the steps. And we went through the steps. And we got to step 8. And I said, well, we're done. And he looked at me and he said, what? I said, well, I'm in prison. They're not going to open the door to let me go out and make an amends. I mean, you know, we're kind of here until I get out of prison. So, you know, like, we're done. And he said, wrong. So he had me get 3x5 cards. He had me make a list of who I'd harmed, how I played my part in it, how I'd harmed them. And he said, start putting those lists together and keep those 3x5 cards. And he said, matter of fact, you're already making amends and you don't even realize it. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, what did you just tell me about your grandmother 2 weeks ago? And what I told him was this. I went to a visiting room, and my grandmother said, it's so good to see my grandson again. And I'm like, Grandma, you see me every Thursday. What are you talking about? And she said, no, my grandson has light behind his eyes. And it talks about in the big book how others will see changes in us before we ever see it in ourselves. And I'm so grateful I was given that opportunity, because she passed away less than 6 months later. And I was able to make amends to my mom. And she fought cancer and had come in and out of remission 3 times. And the 3rd time she said, I can't do this anymore, I'm too tired. And she passed away long before I ever got out of prison. But I need to backtrack here and tell you a little bit. For this alcoholic, when I went to prison, I tried to drag everything in my life in there with me. The dog, I wanted everybody in that cell so I wouldn't be alone. I tried to drag a woman and 2 girls in there with me. She lasted 18 months before she left, and I'll be honest, I wouldn't have lasted 18 days. But something my mom had done that I didn't realize, she had been in contact with that woman. And I received a letter from her one night. And being the good alcoholic that I am, when I got mail call and I saw her name on the return address, I brought it up and I laid it on my desk in my cell, because I knew what was in that letter was she was going to tell me how I'd ruined her life, how worthless I was, and everything else. So for 3 days, I came up with 4,327 scenarios of what was in that letter. And after I got, drove myself all but nuts, I said, I've got to read it. So I opened it up. She said, here's my phone number. Will you give me a call? Well, I knew I couldn't wait 3 more days or I would have drove myself crazy. So I went down, I got in line, I made a call. And she asked me, am I still on your visiting list? I said, yes. And she said, I'd like to come visit you. Now let's face it, people. You got 2 life sentences and anybody on the face of this earth wants to come visit you. You're going to spit out the days, the hours, the times, anything there is. My only response to her was, why? She said, because your mom's been telling me she's been making some changes in your life, and I want to come see you. About 3 weeks later, she came to visit me, and for the first time in my life at 37 years old, I carried on a conversation with a woman without any ulterior motives. Didn't have to worry about what restaurant I was taking her to, what stupid movie I had to sit in, or anything else. We just sat and talked in the visiting room. And only her and God can tell you and answer this next thing, but for whatever reason, she wanted to stay with me. We got married in the visiting room of prison, and she waited on me for over a decade till I got out. Now, me being the arrogant alcoholic that I am, even with 2 life sentences, you could see the parole board. So I went up for parole that first time. I thought, well, I admitted I was an alcoholic. I've got my family back. I'm making amends. They're going to give me a second chance at life. I went to that hearing. It lasted 6 minutes, and they said, Mr. Huff, we will see you in 5 years. And I walked out of that room, and I cussed God, and I cussed AA, and I got on the phone that night, and I told Debbie to file for divorce as the stupidest thing she could have ever done, and let's just move on with our lives. And after I whined and cried for 3 days, she cut me off on that 3rd night. She said, are you done? I'd heard that voice before, so I knew my next answer better be the right one. I said, I can be. And she said, good, because I'm not going anywhere. The girls aren't going anywhere, and we're going to get through this. And I changed my life. Instead of waiting a 6 o'clock count to get up, I got up 15 minutes early and I read out the daily reflection, I read out the big book, and I said a prayer, not for myself. And I got through those 5 years, and I became a husband. I became a dad. I became a friend. And I went up for parole that 2nd time. Lasted about 13 minutes this time. They said, Mr. Huff, we'll see you in 2 years. And my pity party lasted 1 day because I knew what was coming on the other end of that phone conversation. But I changed my life again. And I got up 30 minutes before 6 o'clock count. and I read out the daily reflections, and I read out the big book, and whatever month it was, I read that step. And I said my prayers. And I went up that third time. It lasted 57 minutes. They threw pictures of what I'd done to my father on the table. They talked about things that I didn't even know that they knew I'd done. 73 days later, they said, we'll see you in 2 more years. But I was good with that answer. Because if I got out when I wanted to, I did not have the foundation of these steps, I had not worked this program, and I'd have walked right out that door and failed. And for the next 2 years, when I brushed my teeth in the morning, I liked that man I saw looking back in the mirror. And I found a peace living in a maximum security prison that I had never experienced ever on the streets. When I got through those next 2 years, and I went up for parole, they granted me an out date, and I walked out of prison October 3rd, 2008, 21 years to the day. And there's not one thing that I did to get them gates to open. Because in the state of Missouri, with 2 life sentences, when I was sentenced, you should do 15 years on each. I should have done 30 years, and I got out in 21. My higher power in this program did that. Now, I will tell you all this. You go to prison in 1987 and you come out in 2008, you don't fit in no more. First off, you got these things. You have the internet, you have Google, you have Siri. I didn't know what any of it was. But let me explain to you my first 30 days out of prison. I got home on a Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, 10 a.m., 2 men knocked on my door and they said, are you Brent? I said, yeah. I said, Harold L. told us to take you to a meeting. I went to my first AA meeting less than 24 hours out of prison. Sunday afternoon, my wife told me I need to go downstairs in the basement. There's a couple boxes that I need to go through. I thought there were things of my mother and my grandmother's, and I said, I'm not ready for that. She says, it's not that. She goes, you just need to go look at them. So I went downstairs, and there's these 2 big shipping boxes down there. And they were full of gifts. And I started looking at them, and it said, Merry Christmas, Dad, 1999. Happy birthday, Dad, 2004. The reason I share this with you is there was not one gift in those boxes before 1996 when I went to my first AA meeting, and they told me exactly how powerful this program is. Now, I'm telling you, there's not a person in the face of Missouri that would give me a job when I got out. And when I tell you that, I'm telling you, I got turned down 434 times, and I quit counting. But AA does what only AA can do. I was at Thanksgiving, having dinner. We was going to a meeting. A gentleman asked me how I was doing, how I was adjusting, how things were going. I told him I needed a job. He said, no problem. Wrote a man's name down, phone number. He said, when Thanksgiving weekend's over, give him a call. So that's what I did on Monday. I gave him a call, set up an interview. I went in and interviewed with him. I said, look, I know that George got us this interview. I'm a convicted felon. I've never worked in the car business before. So if I'm going to waste your time, just tell me right now and I'll leave. He said, George, told me you'd be honest, so let's sit down and talk. An hour and 20 minutes later, I left his office. He said, I'll talk to the family who owns this dealership. And he says, I'll get back with you. He called me the next week and he said, when can you start? I said, I can be there in 15 minutes. He said, well, why don't we wait till the following Monday? So I went to work for this car dealership. I started out as a porter. I became a salesman. The last 3 years I was a salesman. I was the number one salesman in the district. I became a finance manager. I became a sales manager. And I became the general sales manager of a Chrysler Dodge Jeep store. There is no way a person like me should ever be given that type of job and authority. But I got that job because of you all. You told me to come to these rooms, get in the middle, and do what you're told. You told me to come in here, work hard, work smart, work honest, and miracles will happen when they're supposed to. They gave me the security code to the dealership. I was in charge of keys to 300 brand new cars and keys to 200 used cars. And you all taught me how to do that. You said, show up and do the job. Now, I know there's a few of you that raised your hands that you was new or had less than 30 days or maybe even have less than a year in here. I'm not standing up here telling anybody that your life is going to be perfect you come into this room. I'm going to tell you that life is life. It has good times and it has bad times. But you work these steps, you work with a sponsor, you have a higher power, you can get through those difficult times. That woman that I told you came back into my life and waited on me for over a decade till I got out, she ended up being in a horrific accident. She spent 9 months in ICU. COVID hit right at the very end, and I couldn't get in to see her. I raised so much hell one night, they put me in a gown, put me in gloves. No one knew what COVID was, really. And they said, you can go see her, you got 5 minutes. I went in the room, she started crying. She said, you've got to take me home. I will not die in this room alone. And I made a decision that night to bring her home. We set up hospice in the house. The girls moved back home. I signed a stack of papers bigger than if you're buying a mortgage on a house. And I'm so grateful I did that because we were all together the last 19 days before she died. And you all showed up like only you all know how to do. At visitation, you brought water, you brought coffee, you brought food. You surrounded me when I needed, and you gave me space when I needed. And my two brother-in-law said, who are all these people here? Our sister does not have this many friends. I said, that's my other family. That's my AA family. And they had no idea. They did not understand. But I did. Now, I really figured that I would probably spend the rest of my life in St. Louis, Missouri. I'd work at this car dealership till I was probably 68 or 70 years old, retire, and that would be my life. I'm a grandpa today. My grandson lives in Kansas City. And, you know, I'm just figuring that's where I'm going to be. God has other plans if we just stay out of his way. I got asked to share my story in Dallas, Texas at a conference in 2019. It's supposed to be in August of 20. Well, we all know what happened in the spring of 20. COVID hit and shut everything down. So I couldn't go there when I wanted to. 2 years later, Stu gave me a call and he said, hey, let's try this again. We got clearance. We can have conference. And he says, matter of fact, he says, I got a great plan. Why don't you come in 2 days early? We'll play golf for 2 days. You can stay at my house and we'll go to the conference. I said, this is sounding better and better all the time. Let's do it. About 6 weeks before the conference, he gave me a call and he said, the hotel double booked and they moved us back 2 weeks. Is there any way you can still make it? I said, I'll make arrangements. Yeah, I'll be there. He said, well, we got some more hiccups. He goes, I've got a commitment, so you can't come in and play golf. But he says, I'll have one of my sponsees pick you up at the airport, take care of you, and y'all. And he said, you'll still have a great weekend. Well, in the back of my head, I'm already bummed because I wanted to play golf for 2 days and be down there for the whole week and enjoy all this, but whatever it is whatever it is. So his sponsee picked me up at the airport, took me to the hotel, dropped me off, and he left. So I'm standing down in the lobby, literally not knowing one person in Dallas, Texas, not knowing what I'm supposed to be doing or anything, and this lady comes up to me and she says, where's your host at? And I said, drove away. She goes, well, why don't you come to dinner with me? I'm taking a couple of the other speakers out. And said, at least you'll hang out with somebody until the conference starts. I said, that sounds wonderful. So I went to dinner that night. And one of the other speakers was there. And she was literally a last-minute fill-in, like in the last 30 days, because a lady had gotten sick, had surgery, and couldn't fly. So she wasn't supposed to be there. Well, we ended up hitting it off that weekend. Her best friend says we were sparking. I'll be honest with you. It's been 37 years since I'd been on a date. I had no idea what I was doing. But we did hit it off. And we dated long distance for a little over a year. I flew out to L.A. and met her daughter. She'd come into Kansas City, met my daughter and grandson, flew into Denver and met my other daughter. She came back and forth to St. Louis. We tried to figure out what we was going to do. I couldn't really ask her to leave L.A. and come to St. Louis because she'd just made partner in a law firm that she'd worked an entire career for. And I thought, well, let's face it, I'm in the car business. It's not life-threatening. If anybody's got a boob, it'll be me. So she talked to her sponsor, and I talked to my sponsor, and here's AA and God just getting a little bit smaller. Her sponsor out here in L.A. and mine in St. Louis had known each other for over a decade. They'd been at conferences together. They'd been on panels together, and they knew everything that was going on. So I figured if anybody's going to make a move, it'll be me. So I put my house up for sale. 9 hours later, I had 4 offers. I closed on it in 18 days. I gave 30-day notice at the dealership. Now, most people in Missouri thought I'd lost my mind and wondered why I was moving to California. And I said, it feels right. And for the first time, that little kid I told you about that walked around in fear, consumed of what you all thought about me, I didn't care because I knew this felt right inside. So I packed up, I moved out here. I had absolutely no job, no opportunity. I had no idea what I was going to do, but I knew it was the right thing. So I moved out here. 2 months later, ended up having lunch with the president and CEO of the Midnight Mission. He hired me on the spot. I've been working there ever since. I absolutely love my job. That lady I moved out here, I asked her to marry me. We're getting married this October the 18th. I have a life beyond words. I have a life that I could have never dreamed of. My sponsor, who I've been blessed to have the entire 28 plus years I've been on this journey, when I moved out here, we came up with a plan of what am I going to do to stay in touch with him the way I need to. Every night, I do a 10-question inventory. I send it to him. He sends me his. We still talk every Wednesday morning. It's just switched around. When I was in Missouri, I was his first call on Wednesday morning at 7 a.m. Now, 7 a.m. my time, but it's 9 his, and I'm his last call on Wednesday morning. He always told me I need to do two things. You always work with a newcomer, and you go somewhere once a week that you never want to end up. I have sponsees back in Missouri I still work with. I have gotten a couple sponsees since I moved to California, and I go into the heart of Skid Row 5 days a week, and I can tell you all I never want to end up there. I have a life beyond words, and if I can sum it up and tell you all this, this is how it is. If I stay in the passenger seat of the car and I let my higher power, who I choose to call God, drive, we get down the road in between the white lines at 55 miles an hour. If I'm an alcoholic, I like to grab that steering wheel and I like put my foot on that gas, and the next thing you know, we're running 85 miles an hour down the road and I'm pulling that car right off into the ditch because I'm running my life. And as soon as I surrender and turn everything back over to my higher power, we back down to 55 miles an hour. We stay between the white lines, and we get down the road when we're supposed to. Because if I got to Dallas, Texas when I wanted to and play my golf, I would not be standing here before you right now because I had never met that woman. God had a plan. He had me be there when I was supposed to. He had her be in my life when I was supposed to. And I want to thank you all for the life I have.